This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
The Folk Strip. The event takes place Saturday, February 23rd from 7 to 10 p.m. at St. David of Wales Episcopal Church, 2800 Southeast Harrison in Portland, Oregon. The event includes dessert and coffee, a silent auction, a raffle, and more. Once in a Boo Moon, Saturday, February 23rd, 7 p.m. at St. David of Wales Episcopal Church. More information can be found at kboo.fm/boomoon2013.
On Wednesday, January 16th, KBOO will broadcast the talk by Michelle Alexander on the new Jim Crow, racism and the criminal justice system, along with a community forum on police and the Portland community. Listen to the talk live on KBOO Radio from 5:30 p.m. to 8 p.m. this coming Wednesday on 90.7 FM and also heard on the web at kboo.fm.
And get together, break up this old Jim Crow. Break it up now.
At the dawn of the day, all the darkened kitchens, the mill of gray, are touched by the radiance that the sun discloses. Oh, hear the people singing bread and roses.
Welcome to Bread and Roses, women's news and public affairs. I'm your host tonight, Leanne Kranz, and our engineer, Delphine Crescenzo. Tonight, we honor Indigenous stories with authors Richard Van Camp and Kevi Martin. Their recent works convey that there is much to learn from what Indigenous peoples have known for a very long time about storytelling. That if one listens carefully, stories can save lives. In the second half of the hour, we'll talk with Kevi Martin. She's an assistant professor at the University of Alberta Department of English and Film Studies, and we'll discuss her brand new book, Stories in a New Skin, Approaches to Inuit Literature. The book has much insight to share with anyone involved in the academic study of groups of peoples or cultures. She really flips the traditional approach on its head. But first up tonight, we welcome internationally renowned author and storyteller, Richard Van Camp, a member of the Dog Rib Nation from Fort Smith, Northwest Territories, Canada. He is the author of the groundbreaking debut novel, The Lesser Blessed, which made me downright evangelical when I first read it. And it was recently made into a new film starring Benjamin Bratt, Chloe Rose, and a cast of amazing newcomers. Richard Van Camp has written several children's books, two comics with the Healthy Aboriginal Network that are, one's available, you can read it online, it's really cool, we'll talk about that, and the short story collections, Angel Wing Splash Pattern, The Moon of Letting Go, and the brand new collection, Godless But Loyal to Heaven. In all of his works, Richard Van Camp transports the reader to his homeland, a place of northern lights and frozen water, true love forever and bare-knuckle brawls. And my dreams have been swimming with all of that stuff as I prepared for this interview. His characters are very human, but heroic in the ways that they protect the ones they love and preserve what is sacred to them. They live amid contemporary realities for sure, but are shaped and guided by the old stories. His writing is so, it's hard to find the words, it's so clear-eyed, and it describes all that is brutal and beautiful about this life on Earth, and offers much humor and healing and ultimately hope, the kind of stories that save lives. On the phone tonight from Edmonton, Alberta, Canada, it is my thrill and pleasure to welcome Richard Van Camp.
Bless you. Bless you. Bless you, Leanne. Masi Cho, thank you so much. I actually have tears in my eyes. Thank you. Mm-hmm. It seems my work here on Earth is done. I can retire now and fly back up to the clouds. Masi Cho, thank you.
You're welcome. You're just one of my favorites. I can't deny it.
Thank you.
So please, Richard, in your words, please tell us about your new collection, Godless But Loyal to Heaven.
Sure. Well, first of all, I just want to say hello to everybody out there. My name is Richard Van Camp. I'm from Fort Smith, Northwest Territories in Canada. And I am, I think, one of the very few members of my nation, the Dogrib Dene Nation, or the Tlecho Dene Nation. There were 200 of us who signed Treaty 8 in 1899, and the rest of us signed Treaty 11 in 1921. My grandparents were medicine people. They didn't speak a word of English. My grandmother knew how to swear in English, but that's about it. So I grew up in Fort Smith, Northwest Territories, very, very tiny little community, 2,500 people, officially quadrilingual. What that means is Chipewyan, Cree, French, and English are spoken at any given time. It's a very beautiful community. We've got, they say we're the third best place in the world to see the Northern Lights, and we have cinnamon bears and black bears and pelicans and whooping cranes and elders and a lot of culture, a lot of great feasts, and a lot of storytelling. So Godless But Loyal to Heaven is my 10th book, and I love it. I'm really proud of it because, you know, when I was working on Angel Wing Splash Pattern and The Moon of Letting Go and The Lesser Blessed, there were these characters like Torchy and Sven and Snowbird and Grant and all these great dudes that just wouldn't leave me alone. And so I started writing these stories in secret. And what happened was, as these stories were starting to be put together, I started to realize that really Godless But Loyal to Heaven is about injustice. It's about facing injustice. It's about facing that Wendigo spirit, the Wendigo spirit. And Leanne, do you know what the Wendigo is?
Zombies, for lack of a better word?
Yeah, I think Wendigo or a Wendigo, I mean, there's about 37 names that encapsulate what a Wendigo or a Wendigo is, but it's really this spirit of never-ending hunger. It's about addiction. It's about greed. It's about, you know, overwhelmance. And so, you know, with On the Wings of This Prayer, the first story, it's really a warning, and it's a story that is also a dream that is sent back in through time to two of the characters in this collection. It's a warning story that if, you know, the tar sands in Alberta are allowed to expand, they're going to actually uncover a Wendigo that was killed properly a long time ago. And if men aren't careful and industry isn't careful, they're going to dig it up. And if it can put itself back together, there's no stopping what this thing can do. And that is a warning that it's based on a real story that I heard a long time ago in my hometown, and I just never forgot it. I don't know if you know this, but there was an elder and a prophet named Ea who lived in Delaney. He passed away in 1940, and when he was a young man, he had a vision. And it was a terrifying vision. He told the leaders, and all of his visions came true. And he said in this dream, he saw a bird so powerful, it never had to flap its wings. And he saw Dene people, and he saw white people working together to dig black eggs out of the earth. And these people were working together to take these eggs and put them in the bellies of these birds. And he saw two birds fly to where the sun goes at night, and they never flapped their wings once. And he saw these birds fly over a big town, a big settlement, a big village, and had dropped two eggs. These birds dropped two eggs on people who looked just like us. And there was a fire so bright, it left only their shadows on what was left of their homes. And he said, we must never, ever help the white people when they come up to the Northwest Territories, to our territory, to Denende, to dig up these black eggs, because a great harm will befall those people that look exactly like us. And of course we forgot, because anytime somebody says jobs, 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 people quickly forget, you know, those old teachings. And I see, you know, right now there's a huge call for uranium mines. You know, we never seem to learn that there's this greed, you know, this huge human greed to just keep strafing the land and raping the land. And we live in really terrifying times where there's third-party interests being made all the time. You know, these agendas are being forced upon us. And that's why I'm really proud about what's happening right now all over the world with Idle No More. So mm-hmm. that really is the first story in Godless But Loyal to Heaven. I think there's some humor in here. I think there's some sensuality in here. But ultimately, this is Godless But Loyal to Heaven is an exploration of what does it mean to be a warrior today? Mm-hmm. What does it mean? What are you willing to stand up for? Where's your line in the sand? And so we have stories in there where there's a young boy. One of my stories is called The Contract, and there's a young man named Bear whose cousin was molested by the high school principal. And Bear doesn't know what to do with these feelings. He just doesn't know what to do. And so he starts on a path of revenge towards the principal. But luckily, he meets a bully in his high school, and they become very unlikely friends. And that story is called The Contract. And I'm actually really proud of it. I think of that story a lot, how sometimes we're left with those feelings of betrayal and theft and deceit. We don't know what to do with them. And the instinct, of course, when you're 16 is to grab a pair of nunchucks and make some throwing stars and start crafting some smoke bombs and, you know, spray paint your long johns black and wear a scarf and, you know, race into the night and go and do something. But, you know, are you really willing to take it where your instincts want you to take it? Or what if you just give it some time? What if you pray? What if you reach out? What if you ask for help? What if you visit your elders? You know, all those things that we should be doing right now. And it's taking that breath, taking that space. But then there are these other shifty characters like Torchy and his brother Sven, who are quite dangerous when they work together. And the last story in the collection is Feeding the Fire, and they make up their mind to do something to the principal at the very end. So you have a warning with the first story, and then in the end, the last story, you have what seems like an execution. And so, but I have to put the pause button down right now, because I'm actually working on a new story right now where you see what happens after Feeding the Fire. So I'm already working on my new collection, and I can't wait to hear what people are going to be saying about Godless But Loyal to Heaven, because I think when you think of Northern writing, you think of writing that is cute and safe, and there's polar bears holding hands under the northern lights, and there's an Inukshuk. And what I really want is to show that, you know, the crystal meth and the crack cocaine and the Oxycontin, all that stuff that is in the South is actually now in the North, and the problems of the South have found their way into the Northwest Territories, and there are new poisons in our community, and for that, we need new medicines, and that's why I wrote the book Children of the Sundance, and that's based on something that happened in our community. 5 years ago, a medicine man had a vision, and he saw a tree, he saw a Sundance, and he didn't know where it was, but he knew it was in the Northwest Territories. And he looked and he looked and he looked, and he found that tree. That tree reached out to him time and time again in the dreams. And it was located in a community, a little place called the Foxholes, which is about 40 minutes out of Fort Smith. And there was a lot of thunder and there was a lot of debate in our community. People were saying, we're not people of the Sundance. That's not our way. That's the way of the South. And to which other people replied, well, what is our way? I mean, try and find a Dene who isn't Catholic. Who are we with the church? Who are we without the church? Who were we before the church? You know, the Dogrib Dene, the Tlicho Dene, we used to pray to the moon. You know, our medicine is rat root. We have different tea dances and drum dances and medicine songs. We're chanters, right? And so what happened was, we knew we couldn't stop the Sundance that was coming because the call had been put out there. And so as great Northerners, we realized that we had to host these drummers and the cooks and all these dancers and all these prayer warriors that were coming up to our community. And the first time we held it in August, it was wonderful. Hundreds of people showed up, and we couldn't wait for the next year. We couldn't wait for the third year. We couldn't wait for the fourth year. And now, a year later, this first August, after the Sundance has come and gone from our little community, our languages are back, Hand games are back. Drum songs are back. Those thunder songs are strong again. You know, it woke us up. And that's why I wanted to write that little book, that little story, Children of the Sundance. You know, how does something like this affect children in the community? You know, when a people wake up.
I love that story in the collection.
Thank you. It actually, my younger brother, who's a lawyer, actually had to put it down because it was so mean.
I know.
And,
little kid.
Just to let the readers know it. I don't know. I think we've all gone to that party where you show up and you have innocence and you have your little plans and you know you have your little rituals, but somebody in the group says, let's play a new game. And they have an agenda. And it's just the cruelest thing. And in this particular case, there's three friends and they're getting ready to graduate from junior high. And one of the characters says, why don't we play the game where one of us leaves the room and the other two who stay behind talk about what we hate about that person and what they need to work on. And when they come back, let's tell them. What a horrible thing to do to that person who has to leave the room. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I played that game. I was the victim of that game.
Well, I think we all are, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, sometimes you want to show up and play spin the bottle, right?
Yeah.
And have some fun, and you realize that there's a new spirit in the room where somebody wants more than just spin the bottle. So I'm really interested in these characters. I'm really interested in how alive they are, the lives that they're living, and I'm really excited to see what people are going to be saying about these stories.
We are speaking with author Richard Van Camp, discussing his new short story collection, Godless But Loyal to Heaven. And Richard, I've read your work, and then this new collection, for some reason, it really made me connect with these recurring characters that have been present here and there throughout your many books. But you kind of, something about, you really connect with the reader in this work. Torchy, you know, he's my new hero. And getting to see Clarence and Brutus as children in the story you just talked about, it's almost like you're writing this book with no ending, and it just keeps expanding, and your characters grow, and it's non-linear. It's really a thrill to read.
Thank you. And actually, you can listen to Mermaids from Angel Wing Splash Pattern for free right now. If you go to richardvancamp.org, there's a radio play, and Mermaids is where we first meet a young man named Torchy, who goes to see a medicine man, an old blind medicine man named Snowbird, and he asks for Snowbird to bless his hands because he wants to win a bingo game. And Snowbird does, and I won't tell you how it ends. Godless But Loyal to Heaven, the main novella in this collection, is what happens to Torchy and to Snowbird and a little girl named Stephanie 6 months after Snowbird ends. And actually, Leanne, I'll let you know, I'm working on a new story called Furnace, where you see what happens to Torchy and Sven and Snowbird, or Torchy, Sven, Snowbird, and Stephanie 6 months after Godless But Loyal to Heaven ends. Mm-hmm. So you're right, it's a never-ending story. I want to grow up with these characters. I'm lucky I get to travel back in time and show what Torchy and Sven or Grant and Brutus and Clarence were like when they were little kids. It's a whole lot of fun.
One thing, as I was recently immersed in all of your writing to prepare for this interview, this theme emerged, and you touched on it earlier. You seem to have created these superheroes, these Avengers, these avenging angels that step in to protect children or women or elders who don't have anyone to stick up for them in some cases, or these people have been hurt as children and they grow up to avenge others. And I love the line in that, I believe it's the fleshing, Bear says, and there I was, anointed finally as the warrior I'd always wanted to be. That, can you discuss that theme a little bit and how it drives your work?
Sure. I see a lot of young people right now who are really connecting with gang culture, and I think that people right now are really looking for identity. I mean, who are our role models? When I was growing up in Fort Smith, it was who could party the hardest, who could fight the hardest, who could drink the most, who could toke the most, and that terrified me. right? It really did. That just was never really my way. I was the guy who always wanted to be the ninja. I wanted to be the shadow warrior, even when I was four. And so growing up, you know, we encounter these injustices. Like, I remember in Fort Smith, there was a man, and frankly, I was actually always scared of this man, who did end up getting a Chinese mail-order bride. And I worried about her. And they, you know, they could be the happiest people on the planet right now. I would never know. But even as a young man, I think it was about 20 when I, or 19 when that happened. And deep down inside, I just got so upset about it. I thought, well, wait a minute here. What's going on? How is this allowed to happen? And I think that those stories, those instincts of how is this allowed to happen, I'm finally able to forge my own gladiators like Torchy or Clarence, you know, the gentler of the warriors, you know, and how am I able to face these demons that I see in the world? Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Larry is beautiful. Larry is the hero of the Lesser Blessed. Mm-hmm. He also has a short story called How I Saved Christmas in Angel Wing Splash Pattern. And he calls himself, you know, the destroying angel, but he also calls himself an ambassador of love and a soldier of passion. So I'm just really interested in how each of these characters deals with conflict or combat differently. And some of them, it's quite sneaky what they're capable of doing. And each one of these young men is at the crossroads of their lives every single time. And I'm just really glad that these stories are connecting with you.
Definitely. And it's very clear that they're each of them come from love. I mean, Their heart's in the right place. And so often they just have their own muscles and instincts and these stories to like get them out of these jams. And it's just so beautiful. Very human.
Thank you. You're very kind. You're very sweet. I could listen to you all night long. And, you know, and this means the world to me because growing up, radio is everything. I used to be a guard for the RCMP. And at night, the prisoners and I used to listen to radio all night long, you know. And so I hope, you know, we're reaching really wonderful people tonight and making people smile and marvel at the written word and just good old-fashioned visiting.
Yay, radio.
I love radio.
Me too.
Radio rules. You'll see more and more people are going to return to radio because everyone's lonely for connection,
mm-hmm.
right? Everyone's lonely for community. Everybody, you know, people want to feel connected, and I think social media is anything but, you know, it's getting easier to not leave the house, mm-hmm. but at the same time, we're human animals, right? We are social animals, and so many of us are just aching to be held and aching to be heard and aching to be believed, and I can't wait to see what's going to happen next.
And, you know, radio offers that mystery. You never quite know what's coming up. What you're going to hear, and that's a dying thing too in some cases. So
Yeah. Well
if you don't mind, I'm a rabid fan of the Lesser Blessed and
sure. From
the get-go, and this new film that came out, I'm just curious, when can we in the U.S. see this new film?
Well, I've got some really good news. The Lesser Blessed took 7 years to make it. The company is called First Generation Films, who produced it, and our director is Anita Doran. And nobody has ever, now I know, Leanne, you've always, since 1996, 17 years ago, I think days after it came out,
you
were in touch. And I thank you for that. Anita Doran read the novel 8 years ago and got in touch with me, and it took us 7 years to turn the novel into a movie. And we have Benjamin Bratt starring as Jed. We have Chloe Rose from Degrassi Junior High starring as Juliet Hope. We have a young, gorgeous Kiowa Gordon from Twilight. They call him the Sexy Wolf. He plays Johnny, and I think the greatest triumph during the seven-year journey was finding a young man from my community, Mr. Joel Evans. He is the star. He plays Larry Soule. And the movie came out on September 9th at the Toronto International Film Festival. We premiered it there. People think I saw the movie before it came out, and I hadn't seen a molecule of anything until September 9th at 4 o'clock when the lights went down.
Wow.
And it's a beautiful movie. I just made a note that, you know, nobody will ever love the movie more than I will. I burst into tears the last time. I've only seen it three times. and it's absolutely gorgeous. There's a couple of adaptations. I won't give it away, but what I saw during the 2 hours of that movie were absolutely stunning. So we actually are bringing it down to the States several times at different film festivals, but we have signed a deal with Movie Central, and it'll be on iTunes. You'll be able to rent it one day soon. What happens is, when you create a movie, I didn't know this a year ago, you send it out to Berlin and Sundance and all these different film festivals, and then you have to wait. Meanwhile, the movie's just sitting there. And when you are asked to premiere at Sundance or Toronto, suddenly you sign on to different translations and distribution deals, etc. So that's what we're doing right now. And then we are going to be able to bring it across Canada and to different parts of the United States. So if everybody could just hang on a little longer, you will be able to get to see the movie. So you can watch the trailer. If you just go YouTube, the Lesser Blessed trailer, that'll give you a hint of what the movie is like. It's a beautiful movie. It's a triumphant movie. And again, we showed it. We were allowed to show it in my hometown, in my old gymnasium, because Joel Evans still goes to PWK High, where I graduated from in 1990. And it was met with applause, tears, stunned silence, and people just didn't quite know what to do with it. And I was quite shocked at people. We didn't get a standing ovation. In Toronto, we got a standing ovation. In Yellowknife, we got a standing ovation. In my hometown, people clapped, but a lot of people just wanted to just be by themselves after. And I spoke to my dad about it, and he just said, "Well, Richard, your movie is a kick to the soul. A, people needed a smoke. B, there was free food in the lobby. And C, people just needed to think. Just let people digest." Well, wouldn't you know, Leanne, the next morning, Facebook and Gmail was filled with Fort Smithers saying, "I need to watch that again. When can I buy the DVD?" Mm-hmm. And I think what happened was, because Fort Smith inspired the novel, a lot of people went into it thinking, okay, am I going to be in this movie? Is my family going to be represented into this movie? I think some people went in with the defense mechanisms on. Hey, and you can laugh all you want, but my brother was at a house party a couple years ago, and this huge guy pushed him into the wall and said, "Tell your brother Richard to quit writing books about me." So, you got to be careful these days. Sometimes people think that you're writing stories, intentionally to go out there and either make a buffoon out of somebody, and that's not the case at all. So the answer to your question is, trust me, if everybody adds me on Facebook, the second I know where the movie is playing in the United States or in Canada, it'll be on there. And to be honest, I just saw First Generation Films, their last movie, The Whistleblower, is on Netflix. So that tells you exactly where The Lesser Blessed will end up. And I have some really good news. We just finished shooting Dog Rib Midnight Runners from the Moon of Letting Go, the story about streaking.
Yeah.
We just shot that movie. It'll come out as Mohawk Midnight Runners because we shot it in Six Nations territory, and we really wanted to honor the director, Zoe Hopkins, who's Mohawk. Mm-hmm. And she said, "Richard, I want to make this movie. I want to adapt it, but I want to adapt it the Mohawk way." And I said, "Absolutely." So that'll be out sometime soon as well.
Wow, good news. Yay.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, well, three naked guys running across Highway 5. I think that's wonderful news.
With those smiles on their faces that you describe so well.
I'll keep it PG, but it's there. I was in awe. I just saw the rough cut, and they're really going for it. They really are streaking. No little fig leaves. This is the real deal.
Well, Richard, is there anything else you'd like to share with our listeners about what you've got coming up or how folks can get in touch with you and find out more about your extensive work?
Sure. Just anybody who wants to get in touch with me. I'm on Facebook every day. I'm on Twitter. I'm really lucky, Leanne. We've got a new baby book coming out in April. It's called Little You, and it is a tearjerker. And we're just about to sign a deal for a graphic novel. I wrote a graphic novel on a traditional justice. Mm-hmm. And the illustrator is a young 17-year-old woman named Crystal Mathias. And she is a genius. She's a child prodigy. And I'm in awe. And it's about the circle sentencing. What happens when three young men are charged for a crime that they're very guilty of, but rather than sending them to jail, they're sent on the land for 9 months. And it's about three young men who are in a little gang who come back as warriors of peace and go about making amends. So that's called Three Feathers. So that'll be out next year. And then, of course, my new short story collection will be out the year after that. So I'm always working on something, and I'm really grateful that you got in touch with me, Leanne. I'm really, really grateful to you. I can't thank you enough because, you know, The Moon of Letting Go came out a couple months ago. We sold out in 2 months, and the new print run will be out any week now. So we're over the moon about that, and I'm just really grateful. Masi Cho, thank you.
You're welcome. And since I mentioned it in the beginning of the hour, do you mind letting folks know how they can read that comic that is posted online that
sure.
you did in connection with the Healthy Aboriginal Network?
Yeah, no problem. So what happened, I have really great news. I was actually, I wrote a sexual health comic book for the government of the Northwest Territories. It's a very funny story. It was approved by the chief medical officer of the GNWT. We worked for 2 years on it. It's called Kiss Me Deadly. Yes, after the Lita Ford song. I worked with a Haida artist named Chris Octour. He likes to be called Christopher Octour. And if you just Google Richard Van Camp, Kiss Me Deadly, you should be able to come to it. You can read the entire comic book for free. It's in PDF format. You can go to the Healthy Aboriginal Network and just Google Richard Van Camp, Kiss Me Deadly, and it'll take you right to the page. We are getting it translated into French one of these days. I'm not sure when, but we're really proud of it. It's funny. It was approved by not only the chief medical officer of the Northwest Territories, it was approved by many community health reps and many nurses who work in the communities. I'm glad you loved it.
It was great. I think it can really reach young people.
I hope so. I hope it can meet, you know, readers of all ages.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Richard Van Camp, for your writing and your storytelling and taking time out on your Friday night to be with us.
Of course. Well, hey, and you know what? I just want to say one thing. KBOO Radio and Leanne and Delphine are a wonderful technician. It's interviews like this that validate all the lonely hours, all the hard work, all the early morning flights, all the cab rides. This interview is what it's all about, and I really wanted to thank you for that.
Thank you very much. Thank you. We're going to take a quick musical break and be back with Kiwi Martin to discuss her new book, Stories in a New Skin, Approaches to Inuit Literature. That was Indigenous with The Moon is Shining off their Circle CD. Welcome back to Bread and Roses. I'm your host tonight, Leanne Kranz, our engineer, Delphine Crescenzo. And now we continue our conversation about Indigenous literature with our next guest, Kiwi Martin. She's the assistant professor at the University of Alberta Department of English and Film Studies and the author of the brand new book, Stories in a New Skin, Approaches to Inuit Literature, published by the University of Manitoba Press. As I mentioned at the start of the hour, Kiwi Martin takes the traditional approach to studying of literature and turns it on its head. She takes what she has learned about the, quote, Inuit way of doing things through her research into Inuit literary traditions, as well as her time spent in an Inuit community in the Canadian Arctic. And she tries to apply these principles and practices in the way she teaches and interacts within her academic community. And she asks the vital question to her colleagues and students, how can our work create positive impacts for Indigenous communities, both rural and urban? Her approach, outlined so well in this book, seems so applicable to other academic studies involving groups of people or cultures. And I must say, to the lay reader like me, the book was fascinating. It's a solid scholarly work, no doubt, but her writer's voice really comes through. She's smart, actually I'll say brilliant, and funny. I laughed out loud more than once as I read this, and I feel changed after reading her words. On the phone tonight from Edmonton, Alberta, Canada, welcome Kiwi Martin.
Thanks, Leanne. Thanks so much for having me.
Our pleasure. In your words now, can you please describe your intention in writing this new book?
Absolutely. Well, when I started out kind of as a young graduate student, it seemed to me that there was a gap in the conversations that we were having in Canada about Indigenous literature. I hadn't really heard very much about the North. I hadn't heard much about Inuit literature. And as I began to do a little bit of research, I found all of these incredible texts and stories and recordings and films, and a lot of them weren't necessarily geared towards a Southern audience. And I should just say, because I know you're in the U.S., when I say Southern, I mean kind of south of the 60s. I mean basically where we are now, Edmonton, Toronto, Montreal, that's all the south when viewed from up north. So initially, I was really excited to sort of share what I'd learned with my colleagues, my students. And after a while, after reading and listening and after spending some time in the community of Pangertung in Nunavut, it became apparent to me that there was so much that we in the South can learn from these texts. They really challenged me in some powerful ways. And so as you said, even though I live in the South, I live in Edmonton, I'm always thinking about what I've learned up in Pangertung and hoping to kind of bring that into what I do today.
Mm-hmm. The title of the book mentions the concept of skin, and as do many of the Inuit stories. Do you mind talking about that concept and how it applies here?
Sure, yeah. Well, I'm so lucky to have this beautiful cover. It's a print by a Cape Dorset artist named Nino Kuluktivi. And it shows a wolf that's actually emerging from inside a woman's skin. And that might sound a bit gruesome, but it's actually a beautiful image. And in starting to learn about the older stories, the stories that have been passed down, the term for those is unikaktuat, I came across so many tales in which animals could take off their skins. The idea is that they're really wearing them like clothing, and often doing that to kind of infiltrate or to sort of sometimes trick someone or even to sort of just have to go out into the cold weather. And I started to think about the text that I was reading as having this similar kind of adaptive ability to sort of put on a skin. And when I talk about skin, I mean something like the skin of the word literature. When we talk about the word literature, you know, quite literally that refers to letters, right, to writing, alphabetic writing. And a lot of what I'm actually writing about is not writing in that sense. It's oral tradition or it's film. But to call it literature is to sort of wrap it in a skin that allows it to kind of infiltrate some of these powerful places like the university. Mm-hmm. And as I thought about this more and more, I began to also think that those of us working in the South, those of us who teach English classes, who are teaching literary analysis and all of that kind of thing, we also need to think about the skins that we can shed and that we can put on to begin to move into other environments, to move out of the academy, to go up north to talk to community members. So it's a complex image, and as those stories are complex, and it can be something that is sort of beautiful and lovely, and it can be something that's quite violent. But I'm thinking about the ways that these different sorts of stories, whether those are Inuit stories, academic stories, sort of move between different environments and the changes that happen to them as they pass through those borders.
You make a point in the book that in the old stories, when characters wear different skins or take them off, that it's often a kind of a temporary thing, mm-hmm. and that ultimately they tend to go back to their true inherent nature.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems in reading your work that you feel that perhaps in a temporary way we can kind of put traditional Inuit stories into these academic terms that make sense to us, literature, poetry, etc. But that the long-term focus of your approach seems to be to actually do quite the opposite, is to change the way the academy is structured, the way the studies are structured, to follow more Inuit principles. And please forgive my pronunciation, it's different than yours. But do you mind elaborating on that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting, you know, I think this is something that's so specific to every community and every institution. You know, here in Edmonton at the University of Alberta, we're in the territory of Treaty Number 6, so it's Cree and Nakota Sioux, and there's also Blackfoot history and Métis history here, and I really want to acknowledge those traditions and how important it is to draw upon where you are locally. But yes, I was really inspired by a conversation that took place around the time that Nunavut was being formed in the late 1990s, where they were really thinking about this idea of traditional knowledge, sort of the ways that things had been done, and they came up with this term, Inuit Kauimayatukangit. Very long term that they usually abbreviate to IQ, which really just means kind of that what Inuit have known for a very long time, or Inuit ways of doing things. And they began to kind of ask, you know, should this new Nunavut government try to incorporate Inuit culture into itself? Like, should they try to sort of bring in Inuit traditions into the way that things are run, you know, in the legislature? Or should this new government, this new political entity, should it be trying to integrate itself into Inuit culture, which had been there for much longer? So I tried to sort of take that principle and think about, you know, literary studies, which is, I guess, what I do. You know, what does it mean to actually try to bring in Inuit tradition into this other sort of space or this other practice, literary study? And is there a way to actually kind of turn that equation around? How can you sort of privilege the tradition that these literatures are coming from, and how can literary studies begin to sort of integrate itself or find ways of being up there? And so it's true, that metaphor of skin, that's one part of it that kind of troubles me, that idea that there's a sort of inner part that is essential and unchanging, and I don't think that's really true, because even in the Inuit tradition, there's always this emphasis on adaptation, the importance of being able to sort of to adapt to new circumstances, to changing circumstances. Some of the conversations that folks are having around climate change are really fascinating. And if anyone is interested, there's a wonderful film called Kapirangayuk, Inuit Knowledge and Climate Change. It's available online at isuma.tv, made by our friend Ian Morrow, along with the filmmaker Zacharias Kunuk. And you'll hear amazing things from elders in there about how Inuit are adapting to climate change, even though it has sort of major consequences for really their rights to harvest and their way of life. But this idea of adaptation is something that really inspired me. I started thinking, well, you know, it's not really a kind of decolonized approach if we're just sort of doing the same thing and bringing in these indigenous texts. We really have to change the way that we're doing things. And that's really, I've learned, a lot harder than it might sound. The traditions that I come from in terms of my academic training, those are instilled pretty deep inside me, and it's going to take years, I think, for me to really unlearn. And I think every time that I go up north, I come back and I'm always a little bit disoriented, like, oh yes, I have to kind of do this thing again. So it's definitely, this book is part of an ongoing process, and I'm just hoping that it'll be part of a conversation about those issues.
Yes, I think it would be very interesting and applicable to scholars and students that are studying any, quote, culture or groups of people. Just seems like a really revolutionary idea, and I wasn't aware. It just really blew my mind when I read your book.
Thank you.
I said, it kind of just flipped everything upside down. I had to think through everything that's been ingrained in me, you know.
Yeah.
So I was wondering if, I understand you've spent summers in the last 5 years or so in the Canadian Arctic in an Inuit community. Mm-hmm. And you say, I was really fascinated with how you say the things that you learned by observing and participating in that community. If you don't mind, if you could discuss what you learned in your time there about storytelling, the stories, and about community, and the things that you wanted to then take back to your own academic circles.
Sure, you'll just have to cut me off because I have a lot of stories about that time. Yeah, we've been so lucky to work with this wonderful program that was started by a fellow named Peter Kolchisky. He's at the University of Manitoba. Been taking students up to the community of Pangertung on Baffin Island. So it's been, this summer was my fifth year with the program. So we go up for 5 weeks and take up about 20 students, and they're from across the country, usually Canadian. And in my own experience, you know, going to Pangertung, it was really one of the most kind of transformative things I had ever done. It was so good for me to get out of the library. I was a PhD student when I first went up there, and it was just sort of staggering. The first thing I realized was that I needed to get some skills. I really needed to kind of learn to do some things other than just read books and kind of write about them. Around me were all these incredibly skilled people, you know, who could make clothing and clean fish and catch caribou and fix anything. So it really shifted my perspective about what an education was, and I thought, man, I've been so unbalanced. So it was a real privilege to begin to learn things like that. So I tried to learn how to clean fish, and I started to really love to sew and that kind of thing. But if to be succinct, I think the thing that I really have learned in Pangertung is what community means. I think, you know, it's easy to talk about community. I think that's it's a nice sounding word. But it's in Pang that I really began to learn about the responsibilities that come with community. Community means people helping each other out. It means the sharing of resources up north, especially the importance of sharing food, of sharing money, of sharing time, all of those things. And you're counting on people, but that means you also have a place. People are counting on you. And it might sound obvious, but to me, it was kind of stunning, and it was incredibly beautiful. And as I came home, I began to notice these really interesting differences in the way that we do things. And one of them is probably just about is about the sharing of food. And one thing I noticed is that when we go visiting in homes in Pangertung, well, one thing we learned right off the bat and that we teach the students is that when you go into a home in Pang, you don't knock. There's no knocking on doors. They say the only people who knock are the RCMP, the police. So even if you've never been into this home before, you just open the door and you walk in. And for most of us, that's just such a difficult thing to do. We actually assign the students that task. Okay, while you're here, you must walk into a home. And just the physical practice of having to do that and work through your body's resistance to walking into this private home, it's really incredible. And then when you're in there, you'll find people are so generous, and there'll be food available, and you know you're supposed to actually help yourself instead of making them serve you. But people are so generous, and the funny thing we find with our students a lot of the time is when if they're offered something, like if someone says, you know, you should eat with us. Some of us have this training where we like to say, oh, no, you know, we don't want to inconvenience anyone. We don't want to be a drain on anyone's resources, that kind of thing. But what I started to realize was that sort of resistance or that desire to not offend is also a desire to not really participate. What it means is that you don't end up building that relationship. So now, even back here in my hometown, I pose that challenge to my students. I say, next time someone you don't know very well offers you something, whatever it is, if a stranger offers to carry something for you, whatever, see what happens if you say yes. Because as soon as you do, as soon as you accept that offer of help, then you are in a kind of relationship. You have the spark of a community there. And the thing that terrifies a lot of people is it creates an obligation, right? Someone helps you and then you need to help them back. But it's actually that network of relationship that builds this incredible community. And so that, I think that was one of the things that really stuck with me and that I try to take into my life here. You know, how can we have that sort of sense of community? And it made me rethink, you know, even my own family. You know, how can I honor my family members in the same way that I see family members honoring one another here? So I could keep going. It's just I've learned so much in Pang, and I'm so grateful to the folks there who've been patient with me, who've welcomed me into their homes. We have a godson up in Nunavut now, and even just sort of becoming part of a family in that way has been so profound for me. So I think of myself as just incredibly lucky.
We're speaking with Kiwi Martin, author of Stories in a New Skin, Approaches to Inuit Literature. I was fascinated in some of the things that she pointed out about different ways of learning and what is considered rude and polite, etc., in terms of, for instance, asking questions. And do you mind speaking about that a little bit?
Oh, sure. Yeah. No, that's another fascinating topic as well. So I talk in the book a little bit about the word isuma, this word that can mean something kind of like intelligence, something that if you have this quality, if you have isuma, this sort of thoughtfulness or intelligence, then that's a good thing. That's something that you should sort of work to acquire. But the interesting thing is that knowledge in an Inuit context, when that word, like to know something, kauyimayunga, like I know, it doesn't refer to just anything. It actually refers to something that you know from your personal experience. And so usually you have to defer to someone who has that experience, because if I just know something from reading about it in a book, which frankly is what most of us talk about in these kind of university circles, then in an Inuit context, I don't really know that thing because I haven't experienced it personally. So everybody sort of, with their own experience, begins to cultivate their own kind of thoughtfulness, their own intelligence. Mm-hmm. But the interesting thing is, from what I've heard, from what I've been taught, is that there's a kind of autonomy that comes with that isuma. In the university, you learn to debate with one another. That's a really important part of what we do here. You know, it's the idea that we can have disagreements and we have particular ways of dealing with them. But our whole system, you know, when I write a dissertation or a book, is that I have to have an argument, right? I have to have a thesis. I'm trying to persuade you. That's actually the reason why the study of literature began, is as this study of rhetoric, right? Persuasive language. Mm-hmm. So I need to sort of persuade everyone of my argument. But in a northern context, that doesn't really make a lot of sense. To try to sort of push your opinion on somebody else really is actually a very rude thing, because you're not respecting the autonomy of their own opinion. And that kind of behavior can be seen as kind of bossy, and that is really associated with the Khallunat, the folks from the south, the white people. And the same actually applies to the asking of questions. We work a lot with elders in Pengertung, and we're lucky to have some wonderful interpreters who would kind of instruct us on protocol around working with elders. So one thing I learned is that our students, the way a lot of us are trained in the South, is that when we show interest in a topic, we want to ask questions. You know, when you're a teacher, it's wonderful to see hands going up. You're like, oh, good, this means engagement. But up in Pang, I learned that to be asking questions, it's got a different kind of connotation. It doesn't really show interest as much as it could kind of actually show a lack of intelligence, because you're not relying on your own isuma, your own intelligence, to sort of figure something out. You're demanding that somebody else explain it to you. But truly, you can't really understand it until you've actually had that experience. So questioning can actually, it can make you seem as if you're not that intelligent, but it can also be seen as kind of invasive, especially if you're talking to an elder. You don't want to sort of question what they're telling you. And this is something I've learned in other Indigenous communities as well, is that sometimes what elders tell you, you won't understand for a long time. It might take years and years before it kind of clicks or you realize that that's what you were being taught. So there's all of these really profound kind of and interesting clashes in the ways that we do things. And I've always found these just so well, frankly, so difficult. First, when I was in Pang, just learning the kind of proper ways to behave, and then coming back to the South, being really struck by those things, being able to see them kind of with a new set of eyes. So again, it's something that I think about now. I can't say that I apply all of those rules in my classroom, but I am learning more and more through the years about what the local protocols are here. My students teach me a lot about that as well. And I think it offers some really important challenges for the way that the university functions. And I think it's going to be a long process, though, to start to really kind of honor those in a meaningful way.
Yes. Again, we're speaking with Kivi Martin, the author of the new book, Stories in a New Skin, Approaches to Inuit Literature. It's a fascinating read. I would recommend it to anyone listening. Kivi, in the last minute or so that we have, I wanted to give you the opportunity to share some information about the Idle No More movement. I know you and Richard have been very involved in that today. Anything you'd like to share with us down south?
I just want to say that I think this is a really, really exciting time. I know in Canada we've been thrilled to see the solidarity, the gatherings that have been happening in the U.S., the gatherings that have been happening around the world. And in Canada, I think we're at a really critical moment where we're having to really face the reality that our government is not honoring its obligations that were laid out in the treaties. And I just want to say that in terms of kind of learning about the Indigenous history of the place that you live in and what your responsibilities are, even today, even if that history kind of seems distant, it's really not that old. And I really think this is something that folks can think about anywhere. For me, living out here in Edmonton, in Treaty 6 territory, to learn about the meaning of that treaty, the reason why I, as a non-Indigenous person, am allowed to live here as a guest, that comes with a certain set of responsibilities. And one of those is to require that my government uphold its promises, because if that treaty is voided, then my right to be here as a non-Indigenous person is really thrown into question. And for me, it's just been such a beautiful thing to begin to learn more about the history of this place, and I'm really honored to walk to work along the River Valley through thousands of years of history. So those stories, I think, exist all over North America. Wherever you are, you can begin to find out more about, you know, why is your family there? What gave you the right to be there? And that's not sort of throwing that into question so much as it asks you, well, how can you honor that? How can you honor those people whose land you're on? Because those communities are still there and they're facing a lot of different challenges. And this movement, Idle No More, has been so welcoming to allies, folks who can sort of, who have common interests. You know, this is about the lands and the waters and protecting those. And that's something that really impacts all of us. So I just think it's such an exciting moment. And again, I think we're really grateful that people around the world are interested in what's happening here in Canada.
Yes. Well, thank you very much, Kivi Martin. It's been a pleasure to speak with you. And thanks for taking time out of your night to be with us.
Thanks so much for having me, Leanne. You have a good night.
Thank you. You all have been listening to Bread and Roses. Our guests, Kivi Martin and Richard Van Camp, discussing Indigenous literature. I'd like to turn the show over now to our engineer, Delphine Crescenzo. She has a special song to play.
Thank you, Leanne, for giving me the opportunity to play the song. Today is my father's birthday. He passed on 3 years ago, and so I wanted to dedicate this song for him. It would have been his 56th birthday. Francis Cabrel, Je t'aimais, je t'aime et je t'aimerai.
Comme un printemps sur mon trajet, un diamant tombé d'un coffret. Seule la lumière pourrait défaire nos repères secrets. Où mes doigts pris sur tes poignets, je t'aimais, je t'aime et je t'aimerai. Mais quoi que tu fasses, l'amour est partout. Tu regardes dans les moindres recoins de l'espace, dans les moindres rêves où tu t'attardes. L'amour comme s'il en pleuvait, nus sur les galères. Le ciel prétend qu'il te connaît. Il est si beau, c'est sûrement vrai. Lui qui ne s'approche jamais. Je l'ai vu pris dans tes filets. Le monde a tellement de regrets, tellement de choses qu'on promet. Une seule pour laquelle je suis fait. Je t'aimais, je t'aime et je t'aimerai. Et quoi que tu fasses, l'amour est partout où tu regardes. Dans les moindres recoins de l'espace, dans les moindres rêves où tu t'attardes. L'amour comme s'il en pleuvait, nu sur les galères. S'envolera du même quai, les yeux dans les mêmes reflets. Pour cette vie et celle d'après, tu seras mon unique projet. Je manierai poser tes portraits à tous les plafonds de tous les palais. Et juste en dessous, j'écrirai que seule la lumière pourrait.